And now to a group of Green Bay fourth graders who have questions about solar, about wind, how electricity works at the atomic level. And in our conversations about the climate crisis, we often miss out on what young people are wondering about. So what questions do you have about the transition away from fossil fuels and how renewables work? It's 800-642-1234. Greg Nemet is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, and international environmental policy. Greg, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, I hope you put your thinking cap on because we're going to serve up some doozies here with these fourth grader questions. Are you ready?
I hope I'm ready. Okay.
I hope your palms are sweating. All right. Yeah. So the students, they split into groups, came up with questions, and we're going to start with a question from Haley on solar.
Hi, I'm Haley. I'm a fourth grade student in Green Bay Public Schools. My team and I were wondering, how are solar panels made? And is it actually clean to make them, or do we use fossil fuels?
Oh, okay. So In Your Wheelhouse, author of the book on solar energy, take us into the manufacturing.
Yeah. Well, first of all, wow, Haley, so well spoken. Great question. There's a lot of benefits of solar. There's no fuel. There's nothing to burn. There's no moving parts. And one of the other benefits is it's made from the second most abundant element in the Earth's crust, which is silicon. And so you take this form that sometimes is like a rock, like quartz or sand, you heat it up in a furnace and you draw out a crystal of crystallized purified silicon, slice it up into wafers, put some other elements on it to make it a semiconductor, put some wires on top of it, some glass, some coatings, so it doesn't reflect the sun, a metal frame, and that's it. And really the only thing in there that we have to be careful about is where the energy comes from heating up that silicon and melting it. And that could be done with coal, as it is in some places, or it could be done with renewables or solar itself. And so there is this idea that we could get to this kind of breeding system where we use solar to make more solar. And then it really is clean. There is some emissions in the way that we heat up solar today, but it's more than offset by the clean energy that solar produces. So really good question and a good thing to think about. But it's a situation that's improving as the system gets cleaner.
Talking just a moment here on solar farms, we've seen lots of proposed solar farms. There's one near Madison that could be the largest one in Wisconsin. Is it more advantageous to create these big solar farms or to have individual families put solar on their rooftop home? What strategy would best address our energy needs as a society?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really think you need a bit of both and even more, like different scales. And that really is one of the benefits of solar. It's all based on these panels that are the size of a small table, and you can use 5 or 10 of them on someone's roof or 100,000 of them in the desert somewhere and everything in between. And so I think it works really well to have big installations that are more that are less expensive because it spreads some fixed costs, but then also local installations that have some benefits for resilience. And so I think that's one of the strengths of solar, that it can work in so many different applications. And there's no new ones we haven't even really applied yet, like putting them on top of cars or parking structures or things like that.
So you can really scale it up, scale it down, make it work. Let's go to Jeff now in Delafield with a question. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. My question is, do we realize or have we calculated how much of the open space in Wisconsin, for example, would need to be covered by solar panels or even wind turbines, for that matter, to meet all of our energy needs? And what is the effect on green space and grasslands and wetlands and forest lands if we were to install enough solar and wind to meet our needs?
Great question.
Yeah, great question. Certainly, that's been something a lot of people have done analysis on. The overall number I would use for the whole world is you do something like 1% of land covered with solar panels would more than enough power the whole world. So you could scale that down to our state and say something like 1% of our land. Just to put it in perspective, about something like a third of land in the whole world is put into agriculture. So, you know, it's not as big a impact on the land as agriculture, but, it's substantial. It can be done poorly. It can be done well. I think one thing I would say that as I've been, you know, working in this area, one thing that's really come up is this idea of it's sometimes called agrivoltaics. So instead of photovoltaics, combining it with agriculture and realizing that you can actually, there are plants that do well with some shade that come from spread out solar panels. There's also grazing that works really well around solar panels. So it doesn't need to be thought of as an industrial facility that takes the place of agriculture or other land or forests, but rather that's something that can work well with other other activities that we value as well.
Jeff, thank you. Let's take another student question here. Another fourth grader, Jillian, is asking about the origins of electricity.
How was electricity first discovered?
Okay, how was it? Tell us the story, Greg.
All right, so now I am sweating because these are good questions that really provoke some thinking. So yeah, if you go back, you know, way back, there's electricity in nature. So people have seen, you know, electric eels and some fish that was observed a long time ago. Lightning is clearly obvious. As science started to make progress in the 1600s and 1700s, there was this idea, understanding of magnetic fields and that electric fields are related to them. And really in the 1800s, we really started to understand how electricity is made, but also start to make it ourselves and start to take full use of it. And so that's this real burst of innovation, probably more than any other period in the last 200 years, where we had like electric power and then lighting coming out of that and radio and later television. All of that happened in the late 1800s with harnessing electricity. So yeah, fundamental invention that people observed, but took a while till we could really harness. And now, you know, it really is considered something that is critical infrastructure we depend on our daily lives. It's not something that's kind of a just for gadgets. It's something we really depend on. So yeah, great question about where this all came from.
Greg, what about static electricity? Because when I'm pulling apart the laundry and my kids are helping fold, you know, you feel all the static electricity. What is happening there?
Yeah, another observation, you know, going way back, it's just basically a building up this electric charge. And in this case, it comes from this static movement, especially in dry environments. And it's the same way that charges get built up in clouds as you have air rising and there's this energy that builds up as the friction of the molecules rub against each other. So you're building up this charge. And then once you get close to something like clothes coming apart or touching something metal, you have this discharge and you see this spark, and it's a small version of lightning in a way.
UW-Madison professor Greg Nemeth works on low carbon innovations and federal policy shifts. His new job, though, is answering questions from fourth graders, which we think suits him quite well. Do you have a great lesson plan in your class that helps young people understand the electric grid or carbon capture or another climate concept? 800-642-1234. Greg Nemeth is back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's Green Bay fourth graders who are leading the line of questioning about energy and renewables here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, kind of sitting back. What do you think Wisconsin elementary school students should know about Wisconsin's energy grid? How do you convey concepts about electricity or renewables to young people? 800-642-1234. UW-Madison's Greg Nemeth studies the process of technological changes, wrote a book about solar. He's doing his best not to be stumped by nine-year-olds for the next 9 minutes or so. So, Greg, it's a windy day in parts of Wisconsin. We're going to move to wind power next. Bristol's group would like to know more about wind power.
My team and I were wondering, how much energy do wind power plants make each year?
Okay, what do you say?
Well, great question. And, you know, first thing I'd say on that is this is exactly the type of question that my students are answering in the problem sets and the exam they'll take later on this week. So these are students in their 20s and they're answering the questions that you're asking as a fourth grader. But the other thing I talk to my graduate and undergraduate students about is that the math you learn in middle school is really all that we use in that class. And so it's all you need to answer really important questions like this one about how much energy you can get from a wind power plant. So a little bit of math goes a long way in energy. So first thing I'd say is, yeah, there's different sizes of wind turbines. They've been getting bigger over time. But for the ones that we see around our state, you can start, and you know, I will just say this, but my students would calculate it. You get about one wind turbine would power about 1,000 homes. And for bigger ones, like now we're starting to do offshore wind turbines, maybe coming to the Great Lakes, then you get from one turbine, you get about 5,000 homes. And usually when you have a wind turbine, you do them in groups because it's easier to make them work together. And for large wind farms, you might have about 200 turbines, you know, 100, 200 yards apart from each other, but together in a farm. And so if you did that with these large offshore wind turbines, one wind farm would power about 1 million homes. So that's about half of the homes in our state. So yeah, you can actually get to large amounts of power by aggregating these wind turbines as they get bigger. And then the one point that always comes up is, you know, today is a windy day, very windy day, maybe historically windy, but it's not like that all the time. And so what do you do if it's not sunny and not windy and you're depending on renewables?
Yes.
That's been a big question that's come up recently. And we're starting to get answers to that. You put renewables like solar and wind together because it's not sunny and windy at the same time. You transmission to link them, the wires, that helps. Storage, that's something that used to be unaffordable that we're now doing in a big way all over the world and in our state. So having batteries on the system to store power for a few hours. And then maybe changing when we use energy so that we use energy for things that we don't need all the time when it's plentiful, and avoid it when it's really scarce. So there's things that we can do to accommodate the fact that it's not windy and not sunny all the time.
You mentioned these offshore wind farms, and I've looked at the pictures where the turbines are in these coastal kind of shallow waters. What is the difference between having these wind farms on land versus offshore?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one difference is that wind is steadier offshore. So just trees and the landscape interrupt the wind, that create turbulence, and that makes it less of a resource. And then even sort of like Lake Michigan near us or Lake Superior north of us, that flat surface leads to much steadier wind. So that's good for producing electricity. The other part, as these turbines get bigger, the real limitations are not so much on the engineering of how you get a big turbine to be built and to operate reliably. It's more into things like, how do you get it under bridges, or how do you accommodate roads to get it where it needs to go? And doing things on water avoids a lot of the infrastructure that we built on land. So as wind turbines get bigger offshore, it becomes more and more appealing.
That's really interesting, because I think I've seen a semi truck hauling these giant blades, and I'm imagining that it would be for a wind turbine. How do you get these turbines to their places and assembled? And these are really giant blades.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that you see some of these challenges of trying to use two trucks to move a blade, and what you do with bridges. What's increasingly being used are ports and waterways. And so if you look at, you know, Superior and Duluth now, that used to be a big, you know, it still is an exporter of iron ore, and to some extent have coal right there. But if you go around those ports now, you see big, long pieces of equipment, which are often wind turbine blades that are being used and shipped around the Midwest. So yeah, water is becoming an important channel for creating this infrastructure.
We have UW-Madison Professor Greg Nemet with us, teaches courses in policy analysis, energy systems, as we're talking about. Now he's doing his best to answer questions that we gathered from Green Bay fourth graders with yours along the way, 800-642-1234. Marcus is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What's on your mind?
Hi. So Bob Ballard, the gentleman who discovered the resting place of the Titanic, has developed a buoy that basically has a spring on the inside and produces kinetic energy, which can be used in any offshore shallow waters, harbors. I guess my question is, why haven't we introduced something like this into the mix for Wisconsin? Because we have Lake Superior and Michigan touching our shores.
Oh, wow. So these power buoys.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're a great question. So they're, you know, the idea is to take advantage of wave power. So this up and down motion that we get, and you know, I've been worked with colleagues last year in Ireland, and someone doing a PhD thesis on that, where they're actually doing this in real world ocean environments to see if they can extract energy. So it's a challenging system. One, because, you know, you're working on the water. So things like corrosion and access to it are all kind of important. So that's real world issue. Another thing is it's a pretty diffuse resource, and that's been true of all renewables. So it's not like we've concentrated a lot of energy into a lump of coal or into uranium for nuclear power. Renewables do have this, you know, I guess disadvantage of they're dispersed. The wind is in lots of places. You need big equipment to collect it. Same with solar. You need, you know, lots of area to absorb it, and same with wave power. So we'd need lots of these devices to actually extract enough to make it worthwhile. So that's a challenge, but you know, I expect we will see things like that. It's a great idea, and it's good you brought it up. Lots of innovation in this area, and some of these things will work and some of these things won't, but I just feel encouraged to see lots of effort in trying to devise some of these solutions.
Marcus, thanks for the question. We have time for another one more, I think, fourth grader question from Colton, who wants to know about energy use at the level of an individual person.
How much energy does one person use in a day?
There, Greg.
Great. That will be a question I'm going to put on my problem set for my class next year. It's a great question. It's one of those that's like sounds simple, but not that easy to answer. The first thing I'd say is it depends who you are. So when we think about energy, it's not just electricity, it's transportation. So putting gasoline in a car and heating, like burning natural gas to keep you warm. If you look overall, if you look at the world, someone uses about 63 kilowatt hours in a day. So those are pretty abstract units. And just to put them in perspective, it'd be like taking a space heater, so something we might be not today when it's so warm, but earlier this week, and having them on full all day. So that's about, we don't normally have that on, but so that would be one person's energy use to be three space heaters in a full day. In the US, we're about four times that. In Africa, we're about 1% of the US. So it really depends on who you are and where you are in terms of how much energy you use.
Greg, thank you for joining us.
Great. Happy to be here. Really enjoyed those questions. Thank you.
Greg Nemeth, professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Thank you so much to the Green Bay Area Public School District. You can have your questions as well, ideas at WPR.org.